office. I mean, again, this is a, I think where I was rationalizing this is because this is a joint commission measure. And that's where the parameters come from.
Is anybody from NCQA or PCPI? Mark, are you still on the line?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
And this is Mark. I'm still on.
Okay,
NCQA, still here.
Briefly talk about your age limit, your lower age limit. Why is 5 years?
Primarily resulted from, you know, a sensitivity issue and a noise issue in the lower population, as we heard. Is, you know, we use a two-year denominator, first of all, and we use multiple diagnoses. And in the current sort of claims data, that was the age where the testing sort of found it to be sensitive enough to capture them appropriately. And below that age, there was just more noise to a level where we weren't quite comfortable including them in the population.
Thanks. Mark?
I don't think I have anything to add. Ben stated it very well.
Okay, great. This is a harmonization issue because, you know, in some cases, you know, a measure will capture a broader group of children than others. And that, we hear, is very much a problem out in the field in implementation. But given that, can we move on to measure 338? Which is the third Joint Commission measure of this group, home management plan of care document given to the patient or caregiver. And I believe, Trudy, was this one yours also?
Yeah, this one's mine too. I think that, you know, just to sort of speak up front, this is quite a concern. And I'm just going to be honest with you. I think for most organizations, the home management plan of care has to incorporate all these five topics but seven actual data points. So I fear that this has become a bit of a homework exercise for the institutions. So I struggle a bit with this. We have to do it. We have to get it done. It's part of Joint Commission, so that does drive it. The concern here, I think, is we look at the rationale. There are now some newer data that suggests that maybe these home management plans of care don't make a difference. I think we can all, in principle, agree that handing someone a patient education document, which we all do every day. I'm a general pediatrician, so I'll share my stripes, is something implicit in what we do. But, you know, the data out there on this is still a bit debatable. A recent study out with Song on how it didn't make a difference in outcomes. You know, we find sometimes that in the outpatient setting, again, this is not inpatient, but I think in the inpatient setting from time to time, these papers can tend to litter the waiting room. So, having said all that, and I'll ask my colleagues to chime in, I tend to agree with the group across the board that this is, a relevant measure. It's very important. I gave a lot of the things that we all agreed, yes, it is, importance is not a question. I gave a lot of moderates as well in my kind of diagnosis, my thinking, too, on this, about the evidence. There's more and more data coming out. It's a little bit, makes it a little bit more circumspect, as you can see there. I think the decision to include this, I'd open this up to the group. I think we need to because it is a CAC 3. It is a principle of what we do as physicians to give families information and all the points that are on it, the triggers, the medications, what to do for a flare, what to do for a true attack, who to call, does speak to all the medical home. I just think it becomes, to be quite honest, a bit of a busy work where each hospital ends up having someone assigned to just go around and check the boxes off to make sure that it's been appropriately filled out. So I think the answer across the board is yes, we should continue it, but with a caveat, and its importance is there. I think we're all in agreement here. Perhaps I see now Kevin maybe has a different opinion, but again, I struggle with this because the data now is coming out that suggests maybe these, you know, people are not using things the way we'd like to do that. So I'll open it up to the group.
Kevin here, since you mentioned my name. My only concern was if we put these other two in reserve, what is it to have just this measure, which is, as you said, is not a high leverage measure for outcomes, is better than giving a discharge education sheet, but it is not, when you actually look at the studies, it is not a major effect modifier for outcomes, unless it's supported by other systems changes, including follow-up calls and assured ways of people back into treatment.
Yep.
So it feels as what would be an isolated measure for hospitals endorsed by NQF, kind of an oddity. And that was my question. I think as a measure it stands okay. And although hearing from you the fact that it feels like it may be more like an exercise than a real substantive care opportunity doesn't feel real assuring.
Right. Well, you know, it's one of those situations where if the family uses the plan, I'm speaking as pediatric, you know, then it works. If the family tosses the plan in the trash can on the way out of the building,
it won't.
It's really sad and amazing that it comes down to something as simple as that.
Yeah.
But isn't it a system change that requires more than just a plan? It requires plan plus a continuity piece.
That's exactly. It's follow-up. That's the data that suggests.
Yeah.
From our getting the patient back into care is really the crowning point. It's the education. I mean, we actually provide daily education classes for the patients that are being discharged. So they have to go to class. We give them a ticket. I mean, we put a lot of steps in place, but Kevin, I agree with you. I think the issue is it's more about the follow-up and getting into a medical home that then manages that care, and you're seeing that patient within a week.
Hello?
Discharge.
Yes, absolutely.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone,
Brandon? Yes, hi. This is Cy calling from Chicago, and I can give a little bit of history of this measure when we first put it out 5, 6, 7 years ago. You know, our thoughts were to actually have, you know, the institutions think more about what they were doing with this measure instead of just, you know, going through check boxes and all. It was meant to be more of a transitional plan from inpatient to outpatient, talk about the triggers, talk about the follow-up care, talk about, you know, controlling medications and things like that. So, you know, even though that this measure may appear on the surface to be a checkbox idea here, at least it starts the dialogue in which patients start to hear controllers, they start to hear about follow-up visits, they start to hear about, you know, primary care involvement. So, you know, all in all, I think that there's been some measures regarding outcomes and, you know, and like showing that this may not change the outcomes. But it's really hard to like gauge how much effort was put in to, you know, addressing the triggers, addressing the controllers, addressing other areas there.
Right.
Yeah, that's part of the issue. I think we'd all agree this is a really important part of management, but, you know, there are a lot of moving parts here. And you know, it's likely that there's going to be substantial variation in the content and the quality of the discharge instructions and the teaching that's given.
Right. But
and it's very difficult to get a handle on that.
Right. And I think when the average length of stay for a pediatric patient is less than 2 days now for asthma in our hands, that makes it tough to get all that training in.
Right, but at the same time, you know, when you got a diabetic in your institution, you put the time work in to, you know, get that newly diagnosed patient educated and you know, along the same lines here. So this, you know, this measure is really, I think it could be brought up to a higher standard if we just start to, you know, tease out those individual ones and say, did they get an appointment?
Right.
Yes, but was that appointment, you know, given a number to a physician, or was it just a generic phone number to a clinic where there's really no doctor identified and time set up for, you know, for follow-up? So
right.
I think it could be taken to like the next level, but I don't think we should throw it under the bus quite yet, just because the outcomes show it may not be perfect in trying to change you know, performance measures.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be too provocative here. I just want to make sure that we give the pros and cons to this. I think it is a that we all agree that needs to continue. You know, we have tried to take some steps to make this more meaningful for our population, and we don't have any data yet, but we're working on it. But I do think that follow-up is the biggest piece that we should be all working
right.
on. Is if they have a medical home they're going back to, then you can answer those questions for the family. And, you know, we're trying to look at some models of, you know, a phone call the next day, as well as maybe a home care nurse for half of the patients coming out. So
right.
I think there's a lot of work that can be done, but how to make the systems across the, you know, the nation be able to adopt this is going to be not an easy thing.
Well, I think it's a start, and it also puts them at a level now where they are thinking about these other additional you know, treatment measures for asthma, instead of just saying, here's your piece of paper, here's your oral steroids, here's your, you know, beta agonist, and like leave the door without really addressing everything else that, that you know that needs to be addressed. And it starts there, I think, and it starts with what we're doing.
Right. Well, I'm echoing some of my colleagues, I think, from across the country too. You know.
This is Reva. I just want to mention that we've seen similar measures like this, and this discussion is fairly repetitive. A couple of the issues with having a measure that just is, did you give them a piece of paper, is generally, again, people have a sense that this is a very much a checkboxy kind of thing, and we've all seen the papers in the on the floor outside the trash can.
Right.
And so I think that what we're looking for is to see these measures evolve into something more robust that really talks about the educational component. Did the patient, you know, understand? Have we even assessed their learning capability, their language ability, their health literacy? Mm-hmm. Are all of those things taken into consideration when you hand them the piece of paper and expect them to act on it? And so just, I think you're going to find that simply handing folks a piece of paper with information on it is really not the kind of measure. We need to move away from that into something much more robust.
I agree, and maybe breaking this thing down into, you know, two separate measures, or, you know, or like splitting this up possibly.
Right.
Looking at this down the road. I agree with that.
So just very quickly, this is Ruben again. Just to take this to the next step, the British have done this in COPD, and there's a very nice article in Thorax where they have a nurse practitioner calling the patients after discharge and checking they're using their medications, if they have any problems with the medications. And they have a sheet on exactly did the nurse practitioner call, when she called, what the response was. And I can email you that article, and some of this can be adapted to exactly what you're talking about in asthma. So it's not just the transition, but actually have a follow-up call but they have a nurse the equivalent of a nurse practitioner in England. So this was done through the National Healthcare Service in England for COPD. What they did, they actually did take it to the next step, which is what we're talking about right now.
And I think that would be very interesting. I agree totally. I think that's, you know, we're trying to do that here. And again, that's what seems to be making the difference, is that personal outreach. Did you get your prescriptions filled?
Right, exactly.
Did you get that prescription filled? What are the barriers to getting it filled? And how can we make sure that you come back in and see us, in the next week or so? Again, not too soon, because the kid's still on steroids, so it doesn't make a difference, but in time enough so that they can internalize this, so it's not too late to reinforce it.
Correct.
Right.
And, you know, when you think about triggers and there's, like, parents that smoke, I mean, it just meant to get people to think about this. But I agree, if there is the next step, which is follow-up with that call, with that patient, and that is very important.
This is Reva. I think we're going to have to move on to the next measure, but I would ask the committee members to really think seriously about whether the measure as written, not as you wish it were but in the future, but as written and currently exists, whether it meets the criteria. You mentioned things around evidence. We've mentioned things around some of the precision of the specifications. So I would really ask you to strongly consider the requirements and the criteria. All right, then we need to move on, and our next measure is 548, suboptimal asthma control. And this measure comes from the Pharmacy Quality Alliance, I think this was yours.
Yeah, this is mine, Ruben Cohen. So basically, again, asthma is an important problem and so on and so forth. So what this one specifically looks at is poor asthma controls, and it's using two rates to look at this poor asthma control. One is the frequent use of the short-acting beta agonist. They defined over a three-month period. And then once you identify the rate in section one that are people who are using a lot of short-acting beta agonists in a three-month period, how many of them do not have a controller medication. And this, the idea is these rates would indicate an overutilization of a rescue medication, the short-acting beta agonists, and those subjects would need an additional controller medication. And from hearing the discussions before on the other measures, anything that we've said would probably apply to this one in one form or another. There was actually a fair amount of controversy on this one. In terms of the quality of the data. The quality of the data wasn't bad. Mostly most people rated high and moderate. But in terms of usability and feasibility down the line.
Thoughts from other committee members?
Kevin here. The literature, as I understand it, with regards to frequent use of beta agonists was not built on a 90-day window. And that's where I get some help from colleagues who may know the literature or at least remember it better than I do. But it was actually measured over a period of 1 or 2 years, and based upon that, there was a pretty strong evidence that persistent use of a short-term inhaler reliever without some controller has clear risk for morbidity and mortality. The fact that they've turned this into a 90-day measure, I don't know if the literature moves itself would be justified as interpreting itself to, I'm not being very cogent here, but I'm not sure that the literature really translates into the shorter window. So thoughts from my colleagues who may know that.
No, I understand what you're saying. I guess I looked at it in a way is 90 days, you don't want to wait a year or two to find out these patients' asthma. They're overutilizing their short acting. That, I guess that's the way I looked at it, not from the literature point of view.
Yeah, I think that would probably generalize to the time period. If you're talking about three canisters, I mean, that's 600 puffs, 300 uses.
Right.
So if someone got a prescription from their pharmaceutical mail-in with and got three dispensers and but wasn't given a controller, and that person had just a mild exacerbation for maybe, you know, and was using it for about 4 or 5 weeks, would that be bad care or good care?
That would be now that you bring the issue up, there is a, again, to go back to your phrase, a misclassification bias. I mean, even, you know, patients use for to prevent exercise-induced bronchospasm, and some of those patients request, you know, several prescriptions at once based on insurance coverage. So there would be a misclassification here.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, because the mail-order pharmacies usually will give you 90-day supply, which will
that's
be three
right.
canisters, whether
and
you use them or not.
That too.
Yes, definitely. that's a good point. That's a very good point, actually.
Your thoughts or concerns about this measure? In general, the folks that responded are rating it reasonably well.
Yeah,
on all of the criteria. Kevin, I think you did have some concerns.
Well, and my concerns were first is, can you interpolate the literature, which doesn't really look at 90 days, to say that there's a health outcome associated with a 90-day risk, particularly with this denominator? I want to be mindful, if this was a severe group or a moderate persistent group, but as I recall from this measure, and you can help me who read it closer, they took a pretty wide swath at
yes.
denominator here. And so you're getting a lot of mild intermittents here who really just have, you know, a little bit of an exacerbation that requires a little bit of symptomatic relief for a few weeks. They probably will be given a better deal in terms of copayment if they go through their mail order. So it just feels like the 90-day window may be too short for this denominator. We might be picking up a lot of, you know, this other stuff that is being, that doesn't relate in the literature to bad outcomes if you don't give a controller.
Right. You can think about an exercise-induced asthmatic, you know, kids playing sports that would, you know, use quite a few. Plus, he had a flare, a significant flare with maybe the, you know, pneumonia or something, and you're kind of lumping that patient in there as well.
Do we have anybody from the measure developer with us?
I wonder if they could speak to, I'm looking here where it's currently being used.
Yeah, I was just going to say that in the Indian Health Services, and I'm wondering, they're using the QI measure, and I'm wondering what kind of data or improvement they've come up with.
Right, agree.
Katie, do we have anybody from PQA on?
I haven't seen them on the webinar yet, so at this point, I don't think we do.
Okay.
It says that it was tested, unless I misread that wrong somewhere, with NCQA. Is that true?
I have to look that again, actually.
Do we have anybody from NCQA still with us?
Yeah, this is Ben. I think it was tested.
Yeah.
It was tested, but it was a one-off. It was not part of our usual asthma, so I can't speak to that test because I wasn't involved in it. But I believe we did work with them at one point to develop and test the measure, but I think it was a one-off project.
Yeah, it says initial testing in 2007 and 8.
Yeah, here it is, yeah, from multiple health plans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your QA, right?
Okay. Well, we can certainly get to the developer and pose the question, which is you're looking for current data and impact and trend data, correct?
That would be helpful.
Right. Yes.
And maybe any analysis of unintended consequences?
Yes, I think that's the biggest point.
I'd also like to see some literature that supports this 90-day window having without controller having risk the same way that the longer term, unless I remember that literature wrong, it really is 1 year, 2 year data on averages, and I just don't know that it translates back into 60-day risk. 90-day risk of not using a controller for particularly with a denominator of this many mild intermittents in it. I just feel like there's a disjuncture between the literature of what they're trying to do, which is very good, and what the literature supports in terms of use of anti-inflammatory meds.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think a couple of things then from what I'm hearing is the trend is very important. It's not 90 days that they're continuing to renew prescriptions for a longer period of time using just short-acting beta agonists without controller therapy. And if other people have used it, the Indian Health Services QI, what kind of data and what kind of use have they got out of it?
Okay. That'd be great. We'll get to the developers and ask them to see if we can provide that information for you for the meeting. All right. Anything else on this measure? Can we move on?
I would just say that the Indian Health Service is probably more close to Medicaid, where they don't have to have a 90-day versus commercial plan. So.
Oh, that's true.
Apples and oranges, a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Anything else? All right. So next measure is 620. Asthma short-acting beta agonist inhaler for rescue therapy. This is from Active Health Management. This is a percentage of patients 2 years or older with asthma who have a refill for a short-acting beta agonist in the past 12 months. And Ruben, I think this one's yours.
Yeah, so but this one is looking at exactly what you said. The idea being is short-acting beta agonists have been shown to control asthma. And if patients have these medications, refilling these medications, and doing this properly could prevent emergency room visits, could prevent physician visits. So there's nothing here about controller therapy. It's simply looking at people with asthma accessing their short-acting beta agonist for relief.
If we look at the ratings submitted, generally they look reasonable, and most people generally rated it high on for the importance criteria. Kevin, you had some concerns? Did we lose Kevin?
Let's see, is this one very similar to 36?
Yeah,
I'm getting confused.
36 deals with controllers.
Okay. Okay, this one's specific.
36 is the one that deals with moderate to severe persistent asthma and having a prescription for what they call a preferred therapy, which is a controller.
Okay.
And this is a short-acting beta agonist.
Right, who've had a refill.
I have to tell you, I apologize, Kevin here, I was on mute and I was talking to myself, which is...
That's okay, I've done that several times.
This is the short-acting one, right?
Yeah.
This is the short-acting one, right. Refill over a, was it a one-year or two-year period?
One year, right.
Looking at using this medication, refilling this medication with the idea of prevention for ER visits and physician visits. And just using the short-acting beta agonist alone, nothing else.
And I had a concern about the, is this sending the right message, I guess, was the one that I was looking at ultimately.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
And, you know, this, is this, I guess I'll just leave it there since everyone said exactly.
Well, it is standard of care, but nonetheless, it's not associated with improved outcomes like
right.
the controller.
Correct.
Driving.
It could actually end up causing risk, creating risk for populations.
I mean, according to them, their 2011 data, so that's the recent data, 42% of asthmatics from data betas did not have any rescue therapy available in the past 1 year. So I guess if you look at it from their small window, not the big picture,
but from
patients need their rescue inhalers.
Except from the denominator that they use,
I think
do
it's all
asthmatics need to? I think this is the one where the denominator included people who may not, you know, that yes, they have to come in once every year for at least an asthma visit. I think that was it, if I have it correct. But it didn't say that. I mean, you could have a person who just came in whose asthma is not really active, but they just note on the record asthma because, you know, the person
has... Yeah, they carry through,
And does that person necessarily need to have that, a short-acting inhaler, if, in fact, they're coming through with that mild aversion? So there's a issue here of this broad denominator, I think, that concerned me, and the message that it's sending, which is to press for what is really relatively easy to get. And I don't know that there's any evidence that getting a short-acting reliever is a difficult problem in any health system. I haven't seen that literature that there's a gap in that.
I don't know. They're saying 42% of their asthmatics did not have any rescue therapy.
But is that a denominator issue where...
No. That's just the gap they identified.
I understand. I guess I'm trying to say is that 42%, could a big chunk of that be people who didn't really need one because they...
Sure. Yeah.
And they were just coming in just...
Exactly.
And their asthma
was... Their asthma was well controlled or, they were doing something else.
Yeah.
I mean, in pediatrics, it would be that they have intermittent asthma. That's how we would class.
Correct, yeah. And maybe not even very active intermittent asthma.
Correct.
And, you know, just this comes up in a couple of these measures. I was going to say with regard to that, you know, we sample quite a bit. And somebody who had mild to moderate intermittent asthma might just have the samples that we had given them in the office, though the reality is we'd have given them a script. They might not have filled it because they were using it so infrequently. I'm just pointing out why those numbers might have been a bit skewed.
Yeah, the sampling would clearly be more of an issue with this measure.
So I was unenthusiastic. I'm not sure other people seem to be more enthusiastic than I was.
Yeah, I said yes as well, even though my numbers aren't in there, but with some hesitation.
There's more hesitation on this one than probably most of the other ones.
This is Reba. One of the comments I keyed off of was somebody said that the use of the rescue medications were not associated with improved outcomes.
By themselves?
Well, it's appropriate.
By themselves, it's not, no.
Yeah.
This is Dr. Bonnie Veer from Active Health. Can you all hear me?
Oh, great. Hi, Bonnie. Great.
Hi. I've been trying to respond, but the line was not open. This measure is really directed at ensuring that anyone with asthma, regardless of severity, has access to at least one inhaler. It's not suggesting that inhalers or short-acting inhalers are going to treat asthma that is persistent or improve the long-term care if they are in need of a long-term medication. What it's trying to address is that everyone should have a rescue inhaler handy, even if they have mild or asthma that flares up maybe once every year. It would certainly lead to dire consequences should they not have a rescue inhaler at their home or on them at the time. And we're looking to sort of decrease the number of not only emergency room visits, but urgent care visits as well. If a patient should just need a quick burst of relief before getting in to see their primary care doctor, that they have that available to them. In fact, one of the comments that we received during the commenting period asked about that, and we responded with that exact statement, that it's looking just to not to alleviate or not to respond to the overuse of short-acting inhalers, but really address the fact that everyone should have at least one available to them.
This may be heresy. Is there a way to describe this a little differently? Because I didn't. Now that you say that, I feel a little more comfortable.
Right, and that's exactly what is described in the measure descriptions.
I have to think about the literature here because if one looks at the bit of epidemiology that's done of people coming to emergency rooms and looking at the medicines they're on, it's usually in the 90% in terms of the fact that they're coming in with relievers. So it's not as though people went up in emergency rooms don't have relievers.
Well, I would like to defer to our local subject matter expert on asthma, Dr. A.J. Sharma. He's going to respond to that.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. So, you know, as I look at the literature that's available, I mean, if you look at the literature that's actually out there, you're looking at how the, how well is your asthma controlled? Not so much do you have a short-acting beta agonist available. And it's kind of unethical to do a study like that because every study we look at uses the number of refills to assess how well their asthma is being controlled. Now, I would sort of beg to differ a little bit. I think that there is benefit to this measure in terms of having the inhaler available if need be, even if you're stage one. If you're allergic to cats and you get an asthma exacerbation, the same thing with an EpiPen. I mean, if you have an allergy to peanuts and you go out to eat, you want to keep your EpiPen with you. So I look at it from that standpoint. I mean, the literature, there's indirect evidence that this measure will be of value, number one. And number two, I mean, looking at our own data, there was 42% of members did not have rescue inhaler therapy in a year.
Did not have a prescription dispensed.
I'm sorry?
Well, additionally, sorry to interrupt you, AJ, but it's not just that a prescription was not dispensed. We allow for completion of this measure not only through claims data for prescription, but also through information from the HIE, patient-derived data, and provider feedback.
HIE?
Yeah, so from electronic medical record.
Electronic medical record health information exchange.
Yeah, and then to Dr. Bonnie's point, patient-derived data, which we feel, sort of increases the accuracy or the sensitivity and specificity of the measure, and also provider feedback.
All right. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, just to me, the literature that I know that has looked at people who, randomly come into emergency rooms or come to hospitals or near-fatal asthmas, they almost invariably all have beta agonists. And so I think that the 40% you're seeing in your data is really potentially a large portion of individuals who have had a diagnosis of asthma that's being carried forward on their record that's relatively inactive, particularly since the way you're defining asthma in your denominator, you've got about as wide a net as you can. And so you're going to have a lot of those individuals who have intermittent mild asthma who are not active.
Would you not agree, whether you have intermittent or mild asthma, that you should have short-acting rescue therapy available to you? That's the only point of the measure.
Yeah, well, the answer is it's sure you should have that based upon the guidelines. The question is the gap that you're seeing, which is this 40%, a real or perceived gap? And if it's a perceived gap because of the fact that you're getting a lot of people with inactive asthma, then it would be putting a measure in play when, in fact, there isn't a gap that needs to be fixed. And so that's the question. It's incomplete in terms of what those 40% look like. And it would be nice, though I don't think you can easily do it, is sample into that 40% and see how many of those are actually active asthma at all.
Agreed. And while we are, of course, limited to technology being what it is right now, we do our best to have a highly specific denominator. While you may refer to it as casting a wide net, we definitely try to drill down and identify asthmatics very specifically, looking for the presence of an asthma diagnosis at least in the past 1 to 2 years. And we're not satisfied with just one diagnosis. We're also looking for an overlap with office visits, refills with medications, or the presence of patient data in the past 12 months indicating that they indeed have asthma.
Okay. Any further discussion on this? We have one more measure after this one. Does everybody feel that their issues have been raised? Okay. All right. Then let's go on to the next measure, which is a new measure, 1876, Optimal Asthma Care. This is a composite measure with an all-or-none composite measure that has three components to it. Kevin, I believe this is your measure.
Thank you. This is a really intriguing measure. I think many of us on the call might be looking at it and saying, is this what we need? And I think heard on the call earlier, and I know that a number of us really like the idea of trying to move towards composite measures. And what they strive to do in this one is to try and look at several components. In doing so, I think that they're on the way to what might be useful activity. Now, this is a measure that's actually in play and being used in Minnesota. So with that little bit of background, I think just briefly kind of walking first through the issue of importance, I don't think that any of us had any problem with that. It clearly is addressing an important issue the same way others are, as David Lang suggested at the very beginning of this call. So do we need to spend any time on that issue of importance?
No, I don't think so, yeah. I think we can.
So then we would go into the, I'm just switching here to PISA. Sorry, I'm going across.
Reliability and validity.
Oh, reliability and validity. Thank you. Reliability and validity. Oh, Lord. So from what I could see from the reliability is that they've done a lot of testing of this measure and it seems to be pretty robust. They've also done auditing of the measure through sampling processes that they have to do to get particularly the survey piece of it. And the only question that begins to emerge for me is on the reliability. And it's the issue that comes up with composite measures, and that is when you have three different elements and you put them together and they're measuring three very different constructs within an illness structure, are you measuring independent constructs? That's important because otherwise you're double measuring. And I think that this does meet that definition because the three different things that they're measuring feels like they're different constructs. But the next question is are they equal in weight enough that and are be appropriately used so that they can actually combine them into the composite score? And then the final piece is how is the scoring done? And is the scoring done in a way that actually continues to represent this composite or not? So I think the problem that that needs to be looked at here in this measure, which is, at least in my mind, identifies three very nice independent constructs in this concept of optimal asthma care, is the one around the control survey. And so I think, just to spend a moment or two on that one, is that they use a series of several control surveys. The control surveys are patient-oriented surveys that are asking questions that are looking to see if the symptoms are well controlled and if the patient's feeling okay with their asthma. These are recommended by national guidelines, and there's a little bit of literature that supports their use. Now, if one looks at the surveys and actually goes to the source documents of the publications, and I, to the try and benefit this group, I took that extra step. And what you see is these surveys were developed in specialty practices. They were part of a large national survey work being done within the asthma community, which was being done to try and build up a survey that could be used in that community. And that's a good thing. And they show good construct repeat reliability and validity as measured against physician opinion of how the patient's doing. The question then becomes is when you plop it into this environment as a composite and use a cut point that was developed in that environment into a different population, do you change the performance characteristics of that survey? And I think at best one can say is we don't have complete information to know. My guess is since they're using such a broad denominator here that they've dramatically changed the population and it, enough so that the population where these surveys were tested in really no longer reflect the population that they're applying it in this measure. And so and I think that leads to the outcome that we're seeing, which ultimately when they applied this measure, we saw only 10% of practices or thereabouts actually get optimal care. Now, in this reliability validity piece, if there is a problem with that construct, it will lead to results that are a little bit skewed. And I think the fact that you look at a question of whether or not the physicians in a large groups of physicians in Minnesota are only getting optimal care in 10% of the time, I'm rounding, by the way, makes you wonder whether it's the bad care of Minnesota or this measure is particularly harsh on this concept of optimal care. And if it is being particularly harsh, my guess is it's happening in that survey problem of translating that original survey work into this measure. So I think we have some incomplete information on validity that relates to the second component, the survey component, that would concern me and would probably warrant some further investigation in a measure that is in the right direction. They could have scored this differently, and the score they could have used was just a simple 1, 2, 3. If they got, you know, documented each of the components and achieved it, a yes, no, as opposed to trying to make it a little more sophisticated scoring system. But that they chose not to do that, and they ended up with the score. And when it comes to the feasibility, should I jump to feasibility, or do you want to spend a moment on what I said on validity and reliability? Sheila?
Whatever. Would anybody in the work group want to comment on Kevin's thoughts on reliability and validity?
Well, I just think that's well thought through. Thank you for going back to the source literature on that. You can easily see that happening.
Let me then go on to feasibility. And so the feasibility then is we've got a measure that we, at least I'm predisposed to want to see move forward, but I'm concerned about this issue on how they use the survey. And you end up with this 10% or thereabouts of practices that are getting optimal care. And it's sending off a very kind of a funky signal, if I can use the word funky, in a public forum, because it's basically saying that a bunch of doctors in Minnesota are just not doing good care. I would expect that a majority of the doctors are doing a pretty decent care in Minnesota and probably would have expected to see an optimal measure in the 50-60% range, maybe the 20-30% range, but being so low, it makes me wonder if there's a construct in the measure rather than the problem in the care that's being identified by the measure. And so that's the feasibility concern I have. All in all, saying that this is a great measure, it needs some more work to better understand it, even though I know it is by what the measure developers have it in practice and they're trying to work with it. So I'd be very curious from the measure developer's perspective to see if I've touched upon anything that makes any sense to them. Or anyone else on the committee, for that matter.
great, valid, really an excellent assessment of what's going on here.
I feel like I stopped the show here. Is anyone else out there?
Yeah, we're here.
Well, so for those reasons, I really didn't feel it was ready for prime time for endorsement. It would definitely feel like something you'd want to investigate, and particularly for quality improvement, to see, you know, is it the measure or is it the quality of the care, but not ready for accountability and putting money behind it, at least in my mind's eye at this point in time.
Yeah, I also think it's a little difficult to know the patient-reported aspects of this, how many times they've been to the emergency room. In some ways, it makes me even more nervous. You know, parents tend to forget that they've been to the emergency room, so.
I'm just wondering, these asthma surveys, are these like the asthma severity score, the Juniper score, or there's something completely
like
different?
The asthma control test.
It's what, I'm sorry?
The asthma control test?
Asthma control test, ACT, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just...
That does pose another problem, and that is they're kind of, because of the measures and the age groups, in some cases they actually don't have measures that work well for different age groups using different measures and trying to fold them all into the same second component piece, which has a little bit of measurement construct issue in terms of cross-validity. They have the asthma control... And then they've got the parent's version of that, but then they have a third instrument as well. So it feels like it's in the right direction, but not quite right yet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a more ambitious measure.
Well, your comment about not being ready for prime time is dead on a couple of these. And you know, we really do, especially in those cases, have got to hold it to a scientific rigor, if you will, that, I don't know, maybe even a little bit higher than some of the more seasoned measures. There's a lot of questions here, as you pointed out, that are unanswered or perhaps unanswerable at this point.
This is Reva. I'm sorry I cut myself off for a couple minutes. Did we hear from the folks from Minnesota?
We haven't, Reva.
Okay. Is
I have
here,
opened their line now.
Talk. Can you hear us?
Yeah. I can't hear.
Yes.
You.
Hello.
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh. Hi, Reva. This is Colette at Minnesota Community Measurement. I'm on cell phone and speakerphone. You weren't hearing us talking.
Can All right,
you hear
Colette.
Us now?
I can hear you.
Okay. I don't know which phone she can hear me through.
Oh, she's speaking. Oh, I don't know.
Colette, we can hear you, whatever you're doing.
Okay. I'm sorry, we were trying desperately to comment. As everyone had indicated previously, this is a first-year measure. It was implemented at a statewide level, so every primary care clinic in our state was submitting data. And we believe that we have some implementation issues in terms of the control tools and a little bit with the written action plan, and we fully expect these results to look different a year from now.
Okay. All right, thanks, Colette.
Great.
So for the folks in the work group, that is some response to your issues or concerns.
Questions?
Any further thoughts, Kevin, on this one?
No, I just would, I'm going encourage us to see them as it develops. It does sound like that they're picking up some of the signal noise issues and some of the other issues that you're going to get with these kind of composites, so go for it. But it does feel a little bit premature for endorsement at the current time, at least in my mind's eye.
Thoughts from anybody else? Okay. Well, congratulations. You guys have gone through all 10 of the measures in a brief time. I hope that we've been able to identify the issues that are most concerning or for which you all had differences of opinion. It provides the measure developers an opportunity to respond to some of those issues. We will be summarizing everything, and this information will be readily at hand for you and all the rest of the members of the steering committee as we discuss these measures and make final recommendations. I think the other thing for this particular group is the issue that was raised at the very beginning is we do have 10 measures for asthma, and many of them cover some of the same ground, maybe with different mm-hmm. approaches. And I think that in anticipation and preparation for the meeting, I would ask the members of the work group to look at how these measures could or should work together and ask yourself the question of do we need all of these measures to have a good group of performance measures for asthma? And if so, which measures really provide the most utility and usefulness, as well as which ones meet the criteria? Your briefing memo outlines a sort of a way of looking at measures that are related and competing, and this may even be one step further. It's, do we have too many measures, and if so, what are the best that define a good group for NQF to endorse? So these are some of the issues we'll need to address at the in-person meeting, and so I'll ask you to begin thinking about that as well. Do I have any questions from the work group before we go to public comment? Okay. Operator, could you open the lines and see if there's anybody in the audience who wants to ask a question or make a comment?
Of course. And to our public audience today, if you'd like to comment, please press star 1 at this time. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, star 1, and we'll pause for just a moment. And I have no respondents at this time.
Great, thank you. So just before we close, I would encourage any of the members of the work group who did not submit your ratings through the SurveyMonkey tool to do so that we can include your thoughts and ratings in with the group that we're going to prepare the summary for the in-person meeting. If anybody based on the discussion today wants to change any of their ratings, we can do that too. You can go in and just put a 2 after your name and re-rate some of the ratings that you previously submitted. But I think today has been a wonderful discussion. I think we've gotten some preliminary sense of these measures, the issues that are most concerning to members of the work group. The measure developers have heard you. They will be present at the in-person meeting and hopefully responding to some of the questions or concerns that you've already raised. And hopefully this preliminary discussion will allow us to focus in on the most important issues as we go through the criteria for each of the measures in our March meeting. If there are no further questions, any questions about the meeting or the evaluations or anything from any work group members?
Will you send out a summary of this meeting?
You bet.
Thanks.
We're putting it together. In about 2 days, we'll actually have the transcript, and that's one of the easiest ways to make the summary. But yes, we will. Anything else? Okay, then I thank you very much for the work that you've put in and that you're continuing to. I look forward to meeting all of you at the March meeting. And we've completed our work on time, and I thank you very much for that. And I hope everybody has a good day. And again, we'll see you soon in March.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I apologize again for being late.
Bye. Thanks, everybody.
Once again, that does conclude today's conference. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today.